Okay, well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Christ Community Church. If you are new here, especially, we welcome you. This day, we have been praying for this day for a long time. This is sort of the day when we want to come out and officially introduce ourselves to the city of Denton, and there's a lot of new faces here, and we're excited to really just introduce Jesus to you, even if you know him. But just get to meet you and have you here with us. Very, very excited. We handed out probably about 1,000 CDs this week just with our parishes. So that is something that is it's kind of weak applause. I never was in youth group, so I don't really know how to get people excited about stuff. So we have a lot of people just totally getting out of their comfort zone, and some of you might even be here because somebody awkwardly walked to your door and said, hey, here's a CD. We're not selling you anything. This is a CD, and so welcome. And so, yeah, we are very, very glad that you are here with us, especially if you come from that. But go ahead and grab a Bible if you brought one with you. We also have a table back there that has Bibles on it, and we are going to be looking at Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. And today we're going to be beginning our series called Loosening the Bible Belt. And we're going to spend the next 4 weeks examining four different characteristics of Christianity that we find in the South, okay, in the Bible Belt. So our goal is to loosen the Bible Belt, but we want to keep on our Bible pants, right? Somebody suggested that, and I thought it was brilliant and genius, and I think it's a big failure that we didn't actually title it that, but a little bit too late. But what we want to do is we want to clear the fog that comes from living in a place that is so inundated with Christian stuff that the message often gets lost. And so when I talk about Bible Belt Christianity, I'm not talking about every church. I'm not talking about every Christian in the South. But what I am talking about is a pervasive cultural force that sort of passes itself off as Christian because a lot of the times it looks the same. The loud and clear message that comes from Southern Christianity is that you can be a committed Christian and therefore be acceptable in God's eyes by simply falling in line with Christian culture. And so you don't really need Jesus in this scheme. See, Jesus is so small to us that we don't think that he can work with our mess, and so we need to help him along, but we also don't think he can work with anybody else's mess, and so we need to help him along as well. And so we set up walls to ensure that sin doesn't get in, all the while not realizing that sin's already here. We are a mess of idolatry, and only Jesus is going to change that. All of us. Whether you are a Christian or a non-Christian, whether you go to church all the time or whether you don't go to church all the time. Only Jesus is going to change this mess of idolatry that we are. No amount of Christian culture is going to do anything about that. In fact, it's going to make it worse if we think that it's helping us. And so this mentality is a seedbed for our topic today, which is hypocrisy. Today we are talking about hypocrisy. When we tell other people to live up to what we ourselves don't live up to, then we are hypocrites. Yet we insist that people believe in Jesus, right? And so we're saying two different things. We say, God is only going to be pleased if you're a good person. Oh, by the way, Jesus is the only way to heaven. You just said that there are two different ways to heaven, being a good person and then believing in Jesus. And let me just say this. You don't need Jesus to be a good moral person. That might upset you, but that's true. There are hundreds of millions of good people, better moral people, if you look at it from the outside, good husbands, good employees, good fathers, good mothers, and they don't know Jesus from Adam. There are many good moral people out there. And yet we're saying, if you want to be right with God, you got to be a good person. And then we insist that Jesus is the only way to heaven. How arrogant is that of us to say out of both sides of our mouth? How can you tell me that if I'm just as good as you guys are, that now I have to believe in Jesus? Why do I need to believe in him? What good is that going to do to me? If I can earn my way, then Jesus is completely unnecessary. Okay, so we're sending these mixed messages. And guess what? Our culture has sniffed it out. And they're saying, no, thank you. I don't want to have anything to do with this. So what does it mean then to be a hypocrite? Hypocrite was actually the word originally used for stage actors in ancient Greece. So stick with me here. We're going to go way back. Okay, the word hypocrite was used for stage actors in ancient Greece. And so a hypocrite was someone who acted out the thoughts and the words of the playwright. Okay, so as actors, listen. As actors, they could be completely different than the roles that they were acting out. I mean, listen, you don't really think that Tom Cruise is a high-level government operative, right? So he is a totally, I mean, he might think he is, actually. But there is a totally different, like, he is a different guy than the role that he plays in his music, in his movies. Jim Carrey is not really a pet detective. He's just not, okay? And so they're able to sort of be different people. And so in ancient Greece, it was not a bad thing to be a hypocrite because actors were telling a story that did not really require them to believe it, okay? I mean, if you don't believe that Gandalf was a real person, then you are not going to stand before God one day. And you won't stand before Tolkien either. Because Tolkien didn't expect you to believe that Gandalf was real, okay? But the word hypocrite takes on a negative meaning in the Bible because the stakes are so much higher with God. Jesus referred to hypocrites as those who were religious actors. And he says this when he accuses the Pharisees of as being those who outwardly appeared righteous to others, but within were full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. He would call them things like whitewashed tombs. He's saying, you look great on the outside, but on the inside you are full of death. You are full of lawlessness and hypocrisy and unrighteousness. So Jesus wasn't fooled or impressed by these guys. And he jumps on them because their supposed righteousness was just an act that did not correspond with who they really were or with who God really was. See, God is not someone that you can take or leave like Gandalf. You can't take and leave God. Take or leave God. See, Jesus would not have gotten onto them for starring in a play. You know what I mean? But we're talking about God. So you can pretend about things that don't matter, but you cannot pretend about the person that matters most. And guys, listen, today the charge of hypocrisy from outside the church towards Christians is well deserved. I would not deny that. Many Christians don't live according to the truth of who God is. But hypocrisy is not just a Bible Belt Christian issue. It is a human issue that stems from our desire to make much of ourselves and to sort of shape God into our own image. See, Bible Belt hypocrisy is just the southern brand of human hypocrisy. In fact, just as many Christians are self-righteous in their own moral superiority that we already talked about, so all humans are self-righteous in their confident assertions that they are basically good people. Because the root of hypocrisy is not about human behavior, but the human heart. Hypocrisy is the fruit of a self-confidence that is completely deceived about ourselves and who we are and about God and who he is. And so here's a question that I want to ask and answer today. What does it look like for us to not be hypocrites, but to live in full accordance with the truth about God. And if it's about being good, then guess what? Everyone is a hypocrite. And that is why hypocrisy is the currency of the self-righteous. When we claim to be righteous and good on our own, how can we be anything but hypocrites? Nobody lives up to their own standards, not to mention the perfect law of God. Like, we take God's law and distort it, and we don't even live up to that, right? So let alone the perfect, righteous law of God. And so Jesus is going to show us that it is not about being good people, but hear me close, an attitude of humility before God. So let's jump in. Luke chapter 18. Hypocrisy is rooted in a high view of ourselves and a low view of God. Let's see what we're talking about here. Verse 9, he told this parable to some who trusted that they were righteous. Now, who is that? It's Pharisees. It's the religious leaders of the day. This is who Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about the churchgoers. You know what I mean? The people who are at church on Sunday, Wednesday, Bible study, and who are doing the chili suppers and all of these things, okay? He's talking to the super religious, committed people, all right? And they trusted that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. And then he says, two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. See, a Pharisee and a tax collector, you cannot get two more perfect strangers here. You know what I mean? Like Bauke and Larry Appleton, okay? You cannot get two more opposite people. People over here have no idea what perfect strangers is.
Is his name really Appleton?
That's his last name. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. We're going to have to edit that out, Nathan. That's a joke. But the Pharisee and the tax collector, they represented just complete polar opposites in Jewish culture. The Pharisee belonged to the most pious movement in Judaism. And the tax collector was the most hated person in all of Israel. There really is not, I mean, we have an equivalent for the Pharisee today, and that's the churchgoer and the self-righteous religious person. But there's really not an equivalent to the tax collector. He's that much of a scoundrel, okay? I mean, maybe it would be a person who is a traitor to the United States, but who lived next door and we just kind of tolerated and put up with, right? That we had to live with and deal with it, okay? So two completely different guys, a religious guy and a scoundrel. And both of them are going up into the temple to pray. But what we're going to look at here is we're going to see that their prayers are completely different. Two completely different prayers here. So let's look at verse 11. Let's see the prayer of the Pharisee. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I mean, that's bold, right? Even like this tax collector here. I mean, usually when we're going to rip somebody, we're going to do it behind their back, but this guy boldly does it out in front of him. And I fast twice a week, and I give tithes of all that I get. Now, how many of you, don't raise your hands, but when you think about Christianity, you think, well, that's what we're supposed to do, right? I mean, that's what God wants of us, okay? So tuck that in the back. But let's look at some characteristics of this Pharisee's prayer. Just as an overview, like he's expecting a big pat on the back from God, like an attaboy from God. Way to go, buddy. Like this is what he's expecting. Look what he does. He stood up to pray. So this is a position of confidence. Like you don't stand in the presence of the king. You bow and you get on your face. You don't stand as if you deserve to be there. Like the higher the majesty, the person that you're with. Now you stand in the presence of me, right? Who's just an ordinary Joe citizen. But you don't stand in the presence of the highest law of the land, in the presence of the king. Now, it's different in America, but when we're talking about majesty and royalty, you get down and you bow in front of that person. So he stood up to pray. This is a position of confidence. The next thing is, notice how he compares himself to other people. Other people, not God. His basis for comparison is other people, not God. And let me tell you this. If you're always citing the sins of other people as reasons for thinking that you are okay, you are using the wrong measuring stick. You've done it. At least I'm not that bad, right? And let me just tell you, when you're doing that, you're like Henry, my 7-year-old, and if he were to go around boasting about being a tough guy when he beat up Max, who's 2. You understand this? Like, there's the standard of toughness is in beating up guys who are tougher than you, not 2-year-olds, okay? And so when we sort of compare ourselves to other people and we say, yeah, look at that scoundrel over there. I didn't do that. I must be okay. No. See, our standard is not other people. It's not what we have done. It's not what we haven't done. Our standard is the most holy, perfect God. So he compared himself to other people. Next, he lacked compassion. You know what he should have done? He should have wept over the sin of these people and had compassion on them. Instead, he uses their failures to prop himself up. See, the gospel allows us to identify with the most heinous of sinners. Now, why is that? Why is it that we should be able to look at somebody who is deep and in dark sin? And I'm talking about Charles Manson. Listen, when I hear the story of Ted Bundy, when I hear the story of all these super serial killer murderers, I'm like, that's not far from me. That's a few bad decisions away from my heart, because my heart is fully capable of being a murderer. My heart is fully capable of being self-righteous, and so is yours. And if you don't believe that, you're lying to yourself. You're not comparing yourself to the heart of God. And so we have compassion on those who are sinners because we know we're no better. That's the point. We know that God has delivered us. The gospel enables us to see people the way they are and not to look down on them in judgment, to prop ourselves up. Next, he uses God to rubber stamp his own efforts. He thanks God, and then he says, I, 5 times. Look what he does. He says, I thank you that I am not like other men. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. So why was he thanking God? God has nothing to do with his activity. And so God is an afterthought to him, and this is simply human effort with a dash of spirituality on the side. And this is really what Christianity, in many cases, has been reduced to. It's all about I and all the things that I've done. And oh, by the way, I'd like to add you, God, as an apostrophe to my greatness. That's what Christianity has become in many, many cases. And then he reduces sin to something more manageable. Look, he just gives it into 4 categories. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, tax collectors. So have you ever said to yourself, well, at least I haven't done that, right? I mean, God's okay with me because God only really cares about is the big things, right? And so I've not murdered anybody, so I'm okay, because that's really what God is upset about. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, isn't it? Because our offense is much deeper than that. I mean, have you guys ever heard of the Pando tree in Utah? Are there any botanists here? It'd be very strange if there was. But have you ever heard the Pando tree in Utah? This is very, very interesting. It covers 105 acres. And every single tree is actually a stem. Okay? It's a stem that is connected to a single root network. And so it's not a bunch of trees that have individual roots. It's one giant network, one root, and it's considered the oldest living organism on planet Earth, right? I mean, it is just this one giant root, and so it kind of manifests itself in thousands upon thousands of stems that grow from it. Am I making sense there? One root, several thousand stems. But when you cut down one of these stems, do you kill the root? No. I mean, you could cut down the entire thing. You could cut down all of those stems, and the tree, the organism, would still be alive and well. And so the same thing happens when we think that avoiding certain sins is enough. See, there is a thriving network of rebellion that is left in our hearts that no human effort is going to overcome, that is going to unearth. See, sin is not manageable. That's the whole point of Jesus coming and dying on a cross, is that your sin is not manageable. It is a fire that has spread. And that's all of us. Not just the people who haven't quite figured out how to act yet. That's a lie. That's all of us. Our sin is unmanageable, and we need somebody to die. And then we also see that he reduces righteousness also to something that is more manageable. He just says two things, fasting and tithing. Now, fasting was only required once a year. Now, he went above and beyond. He fasted twice a week. I mean, this is a superstar, okay? Tithing was only required of income, but many Pharisees, and probably this guy, tithed not just their money, but they tithed their food. So if I went and got a sandwich, I'd cut a tenth off and give it to the temple, right? Probably not that ridiculous, but he would tithe his herbs. So he was beyond the call of duty. And listen, it is a wonderful thing to tithe and to fast. Like, these are great things. See, Jesus isn't saying here, and we need to be clear here, Jesus isn't saying here that it's good to be an extortioner and an adulterer and a tax collector and unjust, okay? And he's not saying that tithing and fasting are bad things. But what he is saying is that they don't get us to God. They don't get us to God. If sin is deeper than we ever imagined, if it's that big root system, if it's deeper than we ever imagined, then we need a righteousness that we can never get on our own. And so we need a righteousness that is not our own. We need a righteousness that comes in from elsewhere. It needs to be given to us. So if we were to summarize the Pharisee's prayer, it would be this. He's the star of the show, and God is a supporting character, right? And if pleasing God, listen, if pleasing God can be boiled down to a list like this, then God is not worth worshiping. If you ever wonder why you have absolutely no desire to worship God, there is probably more than a smidgen of self-righteousness in your heart where you think that you can just check off some lists. Listen, we were made to worship awesome things. And a God you can please by following a list is not awesome. There's nothing exciting about a God that you can buy. Nothing exciting whatsoever. He's not going to capture your heart. He's not going to inspire awe in you. He's not going to inspire joy and pleasure in you. He's not worth it. And when we reduce him down to that level, I mean, no wonder people look and say, well, why would I do that? You haven't shown me a God who is worth getting on my knees for, a God worth getting on my face for. Because what you've said is that you can just make him happy by doing a couple of things. Well, guess what? I can make my wife happy by doing a couple of things, and I don't worship her. And this is the view of God that we put forward. Martin Luther says this, "For what else is it but to blaspheme and defy the lofty majesty of God when he prays and says, 'I thank thee, God, that I am so holy and good that I never need thy grace.'" See, God is not interested in playing second fiddle to our first chair. He wants all of us. But how do we give it to him? How do we give ourselves to God if we don't work for it? The only way to battle self-righteousness and the hypocrisy that comes from it is to do what we see the tax collector do. Look at verse 13. But, anytime you see but in the Bible, that notes contrast, and we're about to see a real contrast here. I mean, once again, there could not be two different people, more different people than these guys, and there could not be two more different prayers than what we're about to see. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And I want you to notice the difference in attitude. He stood far off, while the Pharisee stood confidently. He would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, while the Pharisee thanked God that he was not a sinner. He beat his breast. That's, in Jewish times, the beating of breast was a sign of contrition, of mourning. He mourned over the fact that he was a sinner, while the Pharisee thanked God that he was not. See, the Pharisee went to God with his hands full. "Look what I've done. Look what I've done." And the tax collector was completely empty-handed. And most importantly, he cried out to God for mercy, while the Pharisee had no need for it whatsoever. "I thank you that I am not like these other guys. What do I need mercy for? I'm here under my own steam." And this is the question that should scandalize you. How is a holy God supposed to be merciful to those who have completely rejected him? How? And the answer is even more scandalous. Listen, the word mercy that we see here, it's rooted in the Old Testament idea, and stay with me here, of atoning forgiveness, okay? So to atone for something is to fix a broken relationship, okay? And so the tax collector knew that his relationship with God was broken. He knew that God was here and that he was here and that there was something wrong. But he wasn't just asking God to forget about it. And he wasn't just asking God to pat him on the back and say, "Hey, come on, try harder, buddy." That's not what he was doing. You know, the attaboy pat in football? God's not doing that to him. And nor does the tax collector expect him to. He is asking God, he is begging God to make it right. He knew he had blown it. He had no defense whatsoever, no boast, and he was asking for God to atone for his sin. And so listen to me really closely here. The tax collector, by asking for God's mercy, is looking away from his brokenness and trusting in the provision of God. He's looking, here's his brokenness. This is me. I can't do anything about it. And so he's turning away from that, and he's trusting in the provision, in the mercy of God. In other words, faith. That's what faith means. Faith is not just some strange word that kind of you can attach to any religious concept. Faith is all about the object. It's who are you having faith in? And at this point, he is no longer having faith in himself. He is placing his faith in the mercy of God. Very, very important. Because the miracle of Christianity is that God does not make us atone for our sin. He does it for us. And as Jesus is telling this parable, he knew what he had come to do. He came to die. He came to die on a cross. God's forgiveness does not come through waving a magic wand or patting us on the back. It comes through him sending his son to take on the penalty of our sin. No greater love than this. that while we were his enemies, Christ died to make us his beloved. That is love. And he has faith in the mercy. He believes that God's going to do something about his sin. So guys, to be a Christian is to not be righteous, or to not be a morally superior person. It is to trust that God is going to make good on his promises to do something about your sin. That's what it is. Bottom line. And Jesus gives us his verdict. Verse 14. I tell you, this is Jesus, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. Hear me. Hear Jesus here. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. If you think that you are good enough without God or good enough without Jesus, you will be humbled. Because God is going to show himself one day to you very clearly. And you will see that he is majestic and beautiful and holy. And your good works will seem ridiculous. And you will say, how could I ever have thought that I was this righteous? And you will be humbled. And humbled here is not a good thing. It's not a good thing. But the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So this is the question. How do you get right with God? How do you do it? This is the ultimate in trading places. A righteous man being humbled, a so-called righteous man, wasn't righteous at all. Why? Because sin can't be boiled down to a few things, and righteousness can't be boiled down to a few things. It's the heart that God watches. And if we know our hearts of hearts, we've murdered people in our hearts, just like the people who have shown contempt. We've judged people, right? We haven't done what God has called all human beings to do, which is to reflect his glory on this planet. We haven't done it. To be justified, listen, a righteous man being humbled and a total scoundrel being justified. Do you see, do you see what's happening here? This switching places is making me dizzy, right? And we start off with these two polar opposites, and their prayers are polar opposites, and now their positions are polar opposites. And Jesus is showing us the way. And I want you to listen to this. If you come to God with empty hands and ask him for mercy, he absolutely will not reject you. He will not reject you. He has promised to make good on what he has said. Look at the lengths that he has gone to. Why would he send his own son to die and then take salvation away from you? Because here is what it means to be justified. To be justified is to have a total change in status. The gospel is something that happens in history, and when you believe in it, your status before God is changed forever. Changed forever. Not because of you, but because of what he did. Changed. Period. But how many people only get to the first part of the tax collector's prayer? They stand far off. They won't lift their eyes to heaven. But they stop short of crying out to God for his mercy. And I think it's because of this. They know that if God really has done everything for them, and I mean everything, they know that if their name is taken off the list when it comes to salvation, that if God has done all the work by dying on a cross and purchasing them, they know that there's nothing this God can't ask of them. They know that there's no. Listen, when you have a say in your salvation, then you can sort of hold God at bay. According, your commitment to God can be, yeah, I mean, as good as I'm doing, that's how committed I am to God. But when God has completely been gracious to you, he owns you. And we don't like that. We do not like that. I don't like it. In my flesh, I hate it. But it's become a beautiful thing. See, it's not enough to feel miserable about your sin. That's not what this is about. Faith, once again, is looking away from your works, whether they are good or bad, and trusting in God's provision of salvation. And so it is much easier to be miserable than it is to trust in God. Because when you're miserable, at least you're in control of your own life, right? But instead of turning, so we'd rather be miserable instead of asking God for mercy and coming to him to be our Savior. Because at least we have control. And we'd like to sort of keep the cycle going because I'm in control. And it's miserable. It's a miserable kingdom, but at least it's my kingdom. And this is easier. So this was me for the longest time. In high school, I wasn't a Christian. But I heard the gospel from my girlfriend's dad for the first time. Big Jim Beidelman gave me a book called, jarringly titled, Do Nice People Really Go to Hell? So I'd never even thought about this before. I mean, it just got me thinking. And see, I was a big catch for the youth groups back then because I was such a heathen when I was in high school. Big catch for the youth groups. And one day, I finally decided to go to one instead of ridiculing them the way I usually did. And I got strange looks. And I was treated as if I didn't belong. And the message to me was that I wasn't good enough to be a Christian. And I thought, well, they're nice people. Maybe they're going to hell. That's what I thought then. But in college, I started going to a church with another girlfriend who was with me because I lied to her about being a Christian. Sure, yeah, Jesus, raise your hands at church, I'll do that. You know, what do I need to do? And I'd roll into the church parking lot in my Jeep Cherokee with a giant Danzig sticker on the back window. If you know who Danzig is, you know how funny that is. And for the first time, though, at this church, I was confronted with a message, with my own sin and with the redemption, with the redeeming love of God through the cross of Christ for the first time. But guess what? It scared me. It scared me. I knew that if I bought into this, that I would have to give up my life to this. I knew it. And so I spent the next 3 years running away. And it wasn't until my soul was crushed after looking for meaning in a bottle of Jack Daniels, night after night at Cool Beans. It wasn't until my soul was crushed from that that I start to beat my breast and say, be merciful to me, a sinner. See, I was already standing far off from the temple. I already daren't lift my eyes to heaven. But finally, when I come to my wit's end, I was ready to start saying, be merciful. So finally, by God's grace, I started to mourn my sin, just like our friend, the tax collector. Finally. And I mourned it because, and here's the point, it kept me away from the person that I longed to be with. It kept me away from God. I wanted to know God. And so for the first time, the gospel was good news to me. And it was after staying up all night, drinking beer, and playing Final Fantasy VII so that I wouldn't fall asleep on the PlayStation. And I walked into Denton Bible Church, the 6 o'clock prayer meeting, and I gave my life to Jesus at that point. I said, I want to be a follower of Christ. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. And I was born again at that time. And I didn't stop sinning. I still sin today, but just like the tax collector, I mourn it, and I want to turn away from it as soon as possible. And here's what I'm getting. Just like the tax collector, I am justified. My status has forever been changed, and there's nothing I can do to alter that reality. So let there be no talk of hypocrisy in this church. Hypocrisy is only going to come when we don't turn away from our works and trust in the mercy of God. And when you, if you are not a Christian, and you want to throw eggs at Christians who are hypocrites, understand that that's something that's very easy to hide behind, because you are just as self-righteous as the rest of us, and you need a Savior just like the rest of us. And so the question, we're going to sing now, and the question I want to leave you with, to meditate on the entire time we are singing, is this. Who am I? Am I a Pharisee or am I a tax collector? Let's pray. God, I pray that now you would penetrate our hearts, that you would not allow us to run away from you, that you would not allow us to lie to ourselves, that you would not allow us to do business as usual in lying to ourselves and thinking that we are better than we are, but also, Lord, that we would turn and rejoice that you have been merciful to us. Lord, would we see you as worthy of trusting with our lives? I pray that you would take the seeds that have been sown today in all of our hearts. Lord, hypocrisy is the currency of the self-righteous. And Lord, in righteousness is completely natural for all of us. I pray that you would spare us from it and help us to turn from our own works and turn to you and say, be merciful to me, a sinner. Thank you, Jesus, that you have been this merciful to us. It's all to your glory. Amen.